I'm Rich Egger, and this is In the Tri-States, a review of the news of the past month. A Keokuk man last month was found guilty of first-degree murder for killing his mother. Public Radio's Jason Parrott has the story.
24-year-old Adam Pittman now faces life in prison without the possibility of parole. He was accused of choking 46-year-old Rosa Pittman to death in her home at 1602 Concert Street in Keokuk in the early morning hours of August 30, 2011. A jury of 7 men and 5 women deliberated for an hour before returning the verdict. Assistant County Attorney Bruce McDonald says an 85-minute audio recording of 2 interviews between Adam Pittman and 2 agents with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation was crucial.
I think it was the most important piece of evidence in the case, and it was strongly supported by the physical evidence.
McDonald says a sentencing hearing will be set for a Monday in the near future. The trial lasted 1 week. Adam Pittman was immediately led out of the courtroom in handcuffs and leg irons by members of the Lee County Sheriff's Office. I'm Jason Parrott.
A judge last month tossed out a lawsuit that a large-scale hog farm filed against a McDonough County township. South Morgan Acres claimed new weight restrictions on the road leading to its property cost it more than $230,000. The weight restrictions were imposed in June. South Morgan says the new rules prevent it from using large trucks, but a judge dismissed the suit for being too vague. A Western Illinois industry broke ground in mid-July on a second plant in Macomb. Public Radio's Jim Lenz reports.
NTN Bauer's new 240,000-square-foot facility will be built to the east of its current facility. It should be completed next spring. Production Control General Manager Craig Allen says the new facility will provide greater capacity to produce existing products.
It will primarily be in the tapered roller bearing, which is where our big demand is right now, and it will allow us to significantly expand in that market area.
NTN Bauer will invest about $100 million in the second plant. It will lead to the creation of about 80 new jobs. NTN Bauer's current facility will remain in operation. The city and state will spend about $1.4 million on improvements to the intersection of Bauer Road and U.S. 136. I'm Jim Lenz.
A former longtime host of Morning Edition on Tri-States Public Radio passed away on July 10th. Don Johnson was known for his easygoing ways and his mellow voice.
The day's steady rain and the field's thick mud did not deter dozens of farmers, buyers, and researchers.
He was also known for the signature conclusion to his stories.
I'm Don Johnson.
Johnson worked at the Macomb Journal when former news director Bill Wheelhouse brought him to Tri-States Public Radio. Wheelhouse has said he hired Johnson because he constantly scooped the competition. Johnson retired from Tri-States Public Radio in 2008. Since then, he worked at the E-Waste Recycling Center in Macomb. Johnson was at work at the E-Waste Center when he collapsed. He was pronounced dead at McDonough District Hospital. It's believed he suffered a heart attack. He was 69. Colchester is offering 2 options to the federal EPA for completing a large-scale sewer project. This has been an ongoing story, and Public Radio's Jim Lenz has this update from the final day of July.
Under the first plan, the city would get the work done in 4 years. That's possible if it qualifies for financing through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The second plan would give the city 8 years. That option could be used if the project qualifies for grants through the federal EPA. Mayor Danny Bias says the second option would allow the city to avoid imposing severe rate hikes.
To me, we're better off to span it out over the 8 or 9 years because then we can gradually increase instead of jumping $4 or $5 every year for the next 4 years.
Bias says 20% of the city's households are currently behind on their sewer bill payments. He says rate increases will make it even more difficult for those on fixed incomes. I'm Jim Lenz.
It's pretty easy to sum up the weather this summer: hot and dry. In other words, we're in a drought and there is no end in sight. While the extreme conditions are creating uncertainty for farmers, some producers are more concerned about other issues that they say are impacting their bottom lines. Public Radio's Jason Parrott filed this report on July 26th.
Steve Newberry has been farming all of his life. His farm is located down a winding gravel road just a couple miles west of the Avenue of the Saints in Rural Lee County. When asked to describe it, Newberry says it has a little bit of everything.
Well, we raise corn, beans, hay, cattle, sheep, hogs.
Newberry says one aspect of farming made him stick with it early on.
So I just love cows. That's what makes me stick with it.
Why? What about them?
Just like somebody loves to fish, I love to play with cows.
Newberry says at this point he has about 150 head of cattle. In addition, he has roughly 2,000 acres of row crops and 7,000 hogs housed in two large buildings. While looking out over his farm on another scorching hot morning, Newberry reflects on one of the most difficult summers he has experienced.
77 was bad, 83 was bad, and 5 and 88, but it's yet to see. I mean, this has been hotter than any of them, I think.
Newberry says the heat is especially difficult on livestock producers like himself.
It burned the grass up, so I mean, there's grass out there, but the cows won't eat it, and you can't get the cows to breed back or milk, so you're going to have to supplement the feed there. And the hogs, it's just, even in the fancy buildings, it's really a problem to keep them cool and comfortable. I don't know how people could raise them outside right now.
The high temperatures are also destroying Iowa's corn crop. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that 40% of the state's corn is in very poor or poor condition. Congressman Dave Lobsack got an up-close look while visiting Steve Newberry's farm.
There's your ear. You see, there's no hope for them.
Wow. That's amazing.
Lobsack visited four farms along the southern edge of his district during his recent trip back to southeast Iowa. These stops gave him an opportunity to tell farmers what is going on in Washington, D.C. For example, Lobsack says he is part of a bipartisan coalition that is pushing for a vote on the farm bill, which expires at the end of September. But he does not know if that will happen before Congress goes on recess next month.
Some on the Democratic side are opposed because of the really drastic cuts in the food stamp program. And then there are some on the Republican side who simply don't want any government involvement whatsoever. They don't want some of these programs that we desperately need, that farmers need.
Lobsack is also supporting legislation to extend about a half dozen agriculture disaster assistance programs until the new farm bill is signed into law.
I'd like to be able to cover these folks retroactively who've been going through this and struggling through this drought and these high temperatures in 2012.
These did not seem to be the primary concerns, though, for the 15 or so farmers who came to Steve Newberry's farm to meet with the congressman. They wanted to talk about environmental regulations, in particular the Conservation Reserve Program. CRP land is set aside for grasses and vegetation. The farmers wanted to know why they could not use it to feed their animals during such a severe drought. John Whitaker with the Farm Service Agency says there are certain requirements that must be met before that can occur.
What has to happen is we have to have a county that qualifies by being a 40% reduction in rainfall over a four-month average. The state office confirms their figures, sends it to the national office. They reconfirm it, and then that's released for emergency grazing. Emergency haying can only be released after the primary nesting season.
Whitaker says the primary nesting season for various birds comes to an end next week. The farmer said those requirements should be relaxed during this drought. There were also questions about crop insurance claims and about why the farm bill is not called the food stamp bill. And Steve Newberry wanted to know what could be done to help young farmers get started amidst all the regulations, in particular on hog operations and water runoff.
Get them out here. Get them seeing it. You control the smell in these hogs, and there is no runoff. And then this water thing, I said, look at our pond. I mean, you can look over at that pond, and there's not going to be much water there come next winter. And if it doesn't rain next winter, what's going to happen next summer? That's really going to affect big time. So they're going to have to get these environmentalists out here in the country with some common sense.
Congressman Lobsack says while his focus is on drought relief, he expected to hear about environmental regulations. He says he will look into ways to help local farmers with various agencies.
It may require legislation. It may require more waivers so that the law as it's now written and as it's interpreted is much more flexible so that we can, in fact, be able to find a common sense solution to what are these problems.
The biggest problem at the moment, though, is the drought, because the longer these hot and dry conditions linger, the less the regulations will affect a farmer who has no corn or beans or who must sell their livestock. I'm Jason Parrott.
The new superintendent of the Monmouth-Roseville School District says some of the biggest challenges he faces involve the transition to new curriculum standards and teacher evaluations. Public Radio's Jim Lenz produced this report, which aired on July 24th.
Ed Fletcher has been on the job in Warren County for about 3 weeks. He was previously a high school principal in Staunton, Illinois, so this is the first time Fletcher has been responsible for an entire district. He believes he was hired in part because of his knowledge outside of education.
I mean, I have a business degree. I mean, not that that means anything, but I kind of have an understanding of, as anyone does, if you do a home budget, you know, revenue and expenditures and trying to figure out what, the most efficient way possible. And so that's going to be the biggest challenge, is looking at where we spend money, trying to see where we can save.
You know, when you first settled in behind the desk that first time and you realized that you were a superintendent, I mean, what are the things that you would like to do? I mean, what are some things that you think the district needs to do over the next few years to build? Because, as you say, you need to educate children now, but also you need to look to the future.
A couple things that are coming up in the near future is the transition to the Common Core standards, getting our teachers to understand what the standards are and educate them about the different instructional methods that they'll have to use to teach to those standards. The new teacher evaluation process will be a very big change, not only for our school district, but school districts across the state of Illinois, tying student performance to teacher evaluations. So I think those two right there are a pretty big challenge in and of itself.
And I know that your district particularly, and this was before you were became superintendent, the change in the school day on Wednesday to give educators a little more staffing and professional preparation time, which will be a big change perhaps for parents next year. But I'm talking to people in other districts as well that are saying that the professional development is going to become much more important than it has in the past.
Oh, absolutely. You know, anytime there's a major change like this, the ability to give professional development to your teachers is very important. Because you got good teachers and they understand what's going on, that benefits your students.
So many districts are starting to implement using electronic devices in the classroom, whether it be an iPad type of device, a tablet, essentially. Monmouth, I don't know where your progress is or if you're thinking about doing that in the near future, but it seems to be a trend. Is that something that you'd like to look into at Monmouth-Roseville?
Of course we'd like to look into it. We have to get a plan, get an idea of what's happening. Technology changes so fast. We have to make sure that whatever we put in place is going to benefit students. You know, to have tablets or iPads in a kid's hand just to have them in their hands, I don't know how much that improves their education. But if we have a plan in place and we say, you know, this is what we're doing and this is with the iPads and this is our plan, I think it could be a benefit. And how do we implement that?
What are some things, though, that you would like to do here at Monmouth-Roseville? You're coming in from Staunton, so you've got a somewhat different viewpoint than if you had been internally promoted, so to speak.
Well, I think first and foremost, a cohesive curriculum across grade levels. I mean, I'm a believer of, you know, the cycle of curriculum and instruction and assessment. You know, that cycle of what are our teachers teaching, how are we teaching it, and then how are we determining whether we're doing a good job or not.
Ed Fletcher is the new superintendent of the Monmouth-Roseville School District. He says his biggest job so far has been to get acquainted with the faculty and staff so he can learn their concerns and expectations. Fletcher sees great passion for education among the employees. I'm Jim Lenz.
Western Illinois University is facing another year of reduced state funding while also playing a waiting game with the state. Each vice president at the school is being asked to reduce his or her division's total budget by 2%. That directive came from President Jack Thomas, who says the state cut Western's budget by $3.4 million for the new fiscal year. In addition, the university is still owed around $13 million for the fiscal year that ended June 30th. In a July 9th interview with Tri-State's Public Radio, Thomas said these are critical times for Western.
We want to make sure that we maintain the quality of our academic programs as well as the quality of what we do here at the institution. As I told the legislators, we're still educating students, We're still graduating students. We want them to come here to get a quality and well-rounded education because they have to go out into the job market or into graduate and professional schools.
But what's left to cut at this point?
Well, there's very little. To be quite frank with you, there's very little to cut. And we find ourselves dipping into our reserves. But there's very little to cut.
Could that be personnel, or are you still trying to avoid personnel cuts?
Well, our goal is to make sure that we have no layoffs and no furloughs. We want to make sure that we maintain the faculty and staff that we do have. And in addition to that, with the retirements, we want to make sure that we go out and we have enough funds to recruit quality faculty and staff. But as I mentioned, with those positions that we have that are vacant, we will review those. I've asked each vice president to review those positions to see whether or not we can hold on some of those positions until times get a little better.
The fact that the state funding is being cut and it's late coming in, how does that impact the operation? What does that prevent you from doing that you would like to see accomplished at Western?
Well, we like to see I put some goals out last year on the web in terms of the goals and vision for the institution for the next 5 to 10 years. Some of those things, such as a new welcome center, new academic programs, PhD programs, as well as enhancing various areas in academics, as well as like you mentioned, in terms of deferred maintenance, other facilities and plans that we have for the campus, some of those things are on hold because of that. There are a number of things that we do have to, as we say, bite the bullet and move forward, because an institution cannot stand still during these very challenging times. We have to be a cutting-edge kind of institution, an institution that is very competitive. So there are certain things that we do have to prioritize and we just have to do, but it's a challenge.
Western Illinois University President Jack Thomas says despite the financial challenges, the school cannot afford to stand still. He says it must strive to make progress. Also on July 9th, the Illinois Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board announced an agreement with the University of Illinois to keep open the training facility at the U of I. Plans originally called for that facility to be closed and replaced with one at Western Illinois University. Despite the announcement, Board Executive Director Kevin McLean says plans in Macomb are moving forward.
As far as I'm concerned, nothing has changed as far as Western is concerned. Western is just going to take some while, apparently going to take a little time to, these are tough economic times. It'll probably take Western a little bit of time to get going, but I don't see any change other than that.
The training center in Urbana was set to close after the Standards Board decertified classes and the U of I's Board of Trustees was originally scheduled to vote on its closure. Instead, McLean says the Police Training Institute should be accepting new cadets in the fall. The Wetzel Hall dorm at Western Illinois University no longer exists except in the hearts and memories of those who lived and worked there. The 13-story building was imploded on July 14th during an event that drew hundreds of spectators. Many of those people gathered in Q Lot, the massive parking lot just west of Wetzel Hall. Campus police kept them a safe distance back while the music blared and breakfast was served. It felt similar to a tailgate party. Just before 7 a.m., everything was ready to roll.
1 minute warning.
And before you knew it, the big moment arrived. Witness described it as sounding like timpani drums. The building collapsed inward in a huge cloud of dust. It was an emotional moment for Jason Nelson.
It was actually pretty upsetting to see it go.
Why do you suppose so?
The memories that I have there, all the friends that I've made that I still talk to now, the people that I've met, getting through school, the late nights, up studying, study groups, just the good and the bad times seem just all good right now.
Nelson lived in Wetzel from 2002 to 2004. He's now a catering supervisor for Sodexo at Western. Nelson was in Q-Lot to work and did not expect such feelings to surface.
After it went down, my heart just sank. It's a very hard thing to watch.
Kevin and Lynn Betts of Appleton, Wisconsin, felt the same way. They met years ago as students when they were on the orientation staff at Wetzel and helped fellow students move in. Kevin and Lynn had an on-and-off relationship for a while. Now they've been married 29 years. It all started in a building they just watched come tumbling down.
I thought I'd be more in control, but when it came down, when it was a cloud of smoke, I kind of lost it.
Killed me.
But, you know, we still have the memories.
We have the memories.
Friends and my wife.
Right. But
and they're
now,
here. All of our friends are here.
All our friends are here. But now when we come and we go to see Wetzel, it's not there.
Well, they're going to have a kind of a memorial thing there, you know, so you can remember it. So it's bittersweet. It's
bittersweet.
You know,
yeah, it's a
new chapter
for
Western.
You build a lifetime of memories, and it came down in a hurry, didn't it?
It did.
Yeah, and that's when it hit me. I was fine. I knew she was going to be upset. Then it kicked in for me, too.
My video is not worthy. It shook because I was crying. I can't even post it. I'm going to have to find somebody who has one that's in control. It's just, I'm a baby, but, you know, it's a very sentimental and important thing to us.
We have great memories that we're not going to lose, so we still have that. So.
More than 20,000 people have memories of Wetzel. That's how many students lived in the dorm in the years since it was built in 1970. The university took it offline in 2009. Asbestos abatement work began last October. Contractors have been removing salvageable metals and other items since May. Just a shell of the building remained when that timpani drum-like sound shattered the calm morning air. The implosion was done so early in case anything came up to delay it. Cleanup crews wanted to start clearing the site during daylight hours. But Ted Renner of Western's physical plant says the university heard from some who did not like the idea of a 7 a.m. implosion.
We had a lot of people call and say, oh, can you move it back to maybe 8 or 9 o'clock? You know, we don't really want to get out of bed at 7 a.m. And we literally had people call us and ask us that. And we said, no, you know, we're going to kind of go with this as it is.
Contractors from Controlled Demolition Incorporated and Brandenburg Industrial Services say the implosion came off perfectly. There is quite a bit of dust around the site, coating the grass, bushes, and concrete. The cleanup of the massive pile of rubble will continue for the rest of the summer. The university will eventually turn the site into a park. It could look nice, but for Jason Nelson and Kevin and Lynn Betts and thousands of others, it will never be quite the same as the place they once called home. Volunteerism and civic involvement are crucial to a community's success, but it's becoming more difficult to find people who are willing to serve because of their busy personal and/or professional schedules. A new partnership in Lee County will try to showcase the benefits of service and train future community leaders. Public Radio's Jason Parrott filed this piece on July 2nd.
Leadership, Education, and Excellence, or LEE, is being developed by the Keokuk and Fort Madison Chambers of Commerce, along with Iowa State University Extension. Sarah Cantrell with the Fort Madison Chamber says feedback is also coming in from Lee County's rural communities. She says the goal is leadership development.
People who have that kind of internal urge but don't know where to start, or maybe it's someone who has no desire to have an elected office but really wants to learn more about the county and how they can better engage, how they can be a more informed citizen and a more informed voter.
How far along in the process are we? I mean, it's obviously we're pretty early on. Are we to the point of starting to actually recruit young people to get involved?
You know, that's a funny question because it seems like we aren't that far along, but at the same time, it's coming really fast. The planning for this came together much more quickly than we expected. We had 2 meetings with all of those interested parties, and boom, we had curriculum defined. So it's moving pretty quickly. We have materials that are available right now, brochures, applications. We're getting it up on all of our respective websites. And as far as when we will start, our first session will be September 19th. So considering how fast summer moves, we're moving pretty quickly. The applications, as I said, are available, and the deadline for applications is Friday, August 17th.
Who are you targeting with this program?
We're looking for as diverse a pool as possible. Our instructors currently are looking for a core group of 25. That's a good group to start with for something that's kind of unknown to us at this point, and it's a good size for facilitators to be able to really connect with people. So in that group of 25, we would love to have an equal split of people from West Point, Donelson, all of our communities, but depending on where the applicant pool comes from, if there are 10 from one and 5 from one and 2 from the other, we'll take that too. As far as who specifically, the only real requirement that we have is that the person lives in Lee County. If they work outside of the county, that's fine. But we are looking to build our volunteer base and our leadership base in Lee County and to strengthen our area in that respect. As far as who can participate, we have opened up this first session. We recognize that there are some people who have that drive and have taken a leap. Erica Daughters out of Montrose is a wonderful, wonderful person who just kind of got tired of herself sitting back and thinking, oh, well, this isn't working. I wish this would happen. And she realized, the only way I'm going to make it happen is if I do it myself. So she ran for council in Montrose. She was elected, and she's really helping to make a difference in that community. We're okay with her being an early in her term elected official already participating, because there are things that she will learn from this. But we're also open to people who have had no experience at all in leadership roles, who are just ready to find out more and ready to engage.
It sounds like a little class. Maybe they meet once every few weeks and such. What are some of the things they'll be learning as a part of this program?
We will meet once a month for 9 months. And that's a long span of time, but really the time commitment, we've made it as brief as possible because we recognize these people do have jobs and families to maintain. So we're not taking 2 weeks of time, you know, out of a month to do this. We've spread it out to make it a really manageable program for their personal and work lives. And a lot of the topics that we're covering are things that are county specific, of course. What is our Board of Supervisors? What do they do? How do they do it? And we will cover a lot of history. Why do we have 2 county seats? That was one of the driving forces to begin this program. So that history lesson will be important. And we'll get into some more specific things, like what is the state of healthcare in Lee County? What are our educational opportunities and facilities in Lee County? And intermixed with each of our coursework sessions will be some life skills, some leadership skills, such as servant leadership, communications, decision making. How do you balance the outspoken few versus the good of the whole? So we want to include as much as possible to make it a very well-rounded and very worthwhile program for people.
Sarah Cantrell with the Fort Madison Area Chamber of Commerce hopes local businesses and industries get involved with the Leadership Education and Excellence Program. She says they would benefit because participating employees could develop more of a stake in the future of Lee County. Applications are available at the various city halls in Lee County and at the Chambers of Commerce in Keokuk and Fort Madison. I'm Jason Parrott.
That concludes In the Tri-States. Thanks to Jason Parrott and Jim Lenz for their contributions. For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Egger.